Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
I'm Raul Ramirez, Executive Director of News and Public Affairs for KQED Public Radio. Tonight, INFORM, in partnership with the U.S. Committee for Refugees and Immigrants, is hosting New Lives and Old Dreams, Immigration in America 2012. We're joined by Arturo Rodriguez, President of the United Farm Workers, Dulce Matus, President of the Arizona Dream Act Coalition, who was named at age 27 as one of Time Magazine's 100 most influential people in the world. Deep Nishar, Senior Vice President of Products and User Experience at LinkedIn. And Lavinia Limon, President and CEO of the U.S. Committee for Refugees and Immigrants. We want to start with a little bit of history. And I'd like to start by asking Lavinia, is immigration 2012 different from what immigration was in 1912?
Yes and no. I wasn't there, but as I understand, in the ways that things were different, you often hear people, second, third generation Americans say, well, my people came to this country legally, and they worked, and they, you know, made something of themselves. Well, you didn't have to make an application to come to the United States when you were getting on a ship in Europe. Your application would be made when you landed in Ellis Island. And you were rejected. You could be rejected for issues of health or moral turpitude, or if you were an anarchist. They had certain exclusionary issues, which we still have, by the way. But there were no, you know, 10-year waits for some visa to come through. And so in that sense, it's very, very different. So when people say, well, you should get in line, well, guess what? Really, in 1912, people only had a line they could actually physically get in and see the person who was adjudicating up there, okay? I think that the ways that it's not different is actually in the reasons that people come and the human drama that takes place when people immigrate. I don't think people give other people enough credit for making that decision to leave everything you know and take that chance. And I think people should have more respect for people who make that decision. And then, of course, facing what they have to face here, yes, it was different 100 years ago than it is now, but the, you know, hurdles are still quite daunting.
And the language is quite different as well. I want to follow up with a question that I would like to ask each one of the panelists, and it has to do with language. Any conversation today about immigration becomes a very difficult exercise for everyone involved. First of all, we have definitions, legal definitions, political definitions, functional definitions, which is a difficult way to talk about human beings. Just getting to an agreement as to what to call an immigrant human being is sometimes a challenge. Immigrant, undocumented immigrant, illegal immigrant, alien, legal alien, illegal alien, unauthorized worker, just harvesting, just scraping the top to begin with, and so on. Each one describes a different potential reality. Of the panelists, I'm asking each one of you to look at the immigrant landscape in the United States through the unique window that you occupy in the work that you do. What would we see if we were looking through that window? If we look through your window, what language should we use in describing it? And what would we learn about American immigration if we spent a week or a month by your side? And we'll start with Lavinia.
I thought I was going to be last. Yeah, these terms are, you know, they come and go, in fashion or not in fashion. I always try and start with human being. And, you know, from there, from our work with refugees, we have refugees, and refugees connotate someone fleeing persecution. I mean, that's actually the legal definition. And unfortunately, I think in the last 20, 30 years, the term refugee is sort of taken on a denigrating kind of term, rather than someone who, you know, flees across the Berlin Wall for freedom and embarrassing the terrible Soviet Union. It's like, you know, people who are sitting in refugee camps for 30, 40 years doing absolutely nothing, and they all sort of look the same, and nobody thinks they ever change. I was struck during Katrina that they started using the term refugees from New Orleans, and there's a local broadcast, and there were folks from New Orleans saying, don't call us refugees. We're not refugees. We're citizens of the United States, and it bothered me. I understood, and I was glad they actually knew the term, and that was great, but it bothered me that seemed somehow to be so negative.
Dulce?
I mean, they call me legal, and especially over there in Arizona. And we've been trying to change that language from illegal to undocumented. Even when we're in interviews or protests, it's like, don't call me illegal because I'm not an object. Call me undocumented. But we're recently also being challenged on that definition of being undocumented, because Dreamers are very well documented. We have our school records. We have our medical records. We have our degrees. So we're not undocumented. And I was recently challenged with that concept. And I define myself as an American without a social security number. And I think people need to put that into perspective and think ourselves as an American, because we have everything, our roots, our culture is here, the language. And I also want to challenge you to stop calling us undocumented, because we are very well documented. We've been here since we're children, and we're ready to contribute to our country.
Deep, what would we learn if we look through that window that you experience every day in your life? What would we learn about American immigration and immigrant life?
So I came to this country almost to the day 22 years ago, and you know, I didn't have my first taste of vanilla ice cream here, but I had my first taste of what a digital map looked like, because I came to university and they handed me a map and said, you're here and go there. And I had never seen a map in my entire life, although I was, you know, an engineer by training. Because, not a paper map anyway, because in India, and even to this day, if you want to go someplace, they'll say, well, why don't you walk 200 paces, you'll see a store with this sign, take a right and ask somebody there, and they'll tell you where to go. After 20 minutes, you can't find a space. But in terms of the labels and the monikers, I've pretty much seen the entire gamut of the alphabet soup of all government sort of cards. I came here on F1 visa, which is a student visa. When I finished my graduate education, I was on an EAD, which was a temporary work visa that they give to students. From there, I became an H-1B, which was very trying, and was there for a while. After that, I think my status changed. I got an I-485, then became an I-140, then became a green card, which is a resident alien. So yes, I have been an alien once in my life, courtesy of the INS. And then after 5 or 7 years of being a resident alien, I became a naturalized U.S. citizen, which I'm sure also has some alphabet soup associated with it. So I've seen a lot of the alphabet in my life here.
Alphabets and numbers.
And numbers, that's right.
Arturo, your window, what do we see through it?
Well, you know, when you look at farm workers today, the reality is that if you begin to experience them, I mean, you would ask them, you know, just imagine a farm worker that is an immigrant, that has traveled from Mexico or some other country to come here to the United States, that spent several days, spent lots of money and risked their lives to cross the desert in Arizona, California, some particular state. And they get here, and they come to work in agriculture. They're part of the harvest, of picking and harvesting the most bountiful amount of fruits and vegetables known in this world today. And yet, they're referred to automatically when they do that as alien, as illegals, because they've done that. And they work in that particular field. And if you go on, you can imagine that when a worker comes here and they sweat and they sacrifice, they work in these conditions with the heat, oftentimes well above 100 degrees, and they suffer from injuries, heat stress. We've had 24 farm workers that have died since 2005, and yet this is the state that put, finally, after decades of fighting, put regulations in place to control the use of and the give folks tolerable conditions to work in. And those workers are called lawbreakers. And yet the reason that they're dying from heat stress is because of the violations that the growers do in the fields, and they don't abide by the laws in terms of providing them shaver wool or providing them with drinking water or providing them with the basics that they need, the breaks that they need. And so you hear all these terms utilized against farm workers, and yet if it wasn't for farm workers today, we wouldn't have the fruits and vegetables that we all utilize at our tables every time we eat.
Well, you're touching a lot of points that I'd like to go back to in a little while, but I do want to stay with you on something. Over the last several decades in your work with United Farm Workers, you have been seeing an evolution in the farm worker human landscape in geographic, not national necessarily, geographic origin, culturally, and even linguistically, as we were discussing recently. What are you seeing now, and how is this changing your approach to organizing the this potential workforce and representing this workforce?
Well, it's an excellent question, Raul. I mean, today, what you see in agriculture, first of all, it's the U.S. Department of Labor. They estimate that it's the workforce is at least 50% plus without papers here in the United States today. Immigrant workers that don't have papers, don't have legal status in the country. And then just based on our own experiences when we go out to the fields, you find that in reality it's probably 60 to 80%. And now you see a whole new wave of farm workers. Since the 1970s, we see very few, if any, legal residents or citizens, American citizens, that are actually working in the fields today. And so nowadays, it's not only the immigrants that have come from the urban communities throughout Mexico and other countries, but you find the indigenous workers that come here not even knowing Spanish. And so we're having to change, because of the demographic change of the workforce, change in terms of how we deal with farm workers, who we hire, that we hire folks that can relate to the Oaxacan community or other indigenous communities that come here and that are part of the workforce today. So it's become a challenge, and it's become an issue that we've had to deal with and we've had to change, and yet you find very few others that are willing to make those changes, our school systems and other agencies that don't take into account the demographical change that's taken place among farm workers in these rural communities.
Something else to go back to. I think we could make this a several hours gathering.
That's for sure.
But I want to go back to Lavinia. I'm not picking on you. I'm just part of the American narrative about migration is our role as a place of refuge. That is, the United States is a place of refuge that opens its arms to the oppressed and to the needy looking for liberty. How accurate is that narrative in 2012?
It's a little frayed. I would say that getting here as a refugee is extraordinarily difficult. There are 12 million refugees in the world. The United States is bringing about 60,000 a year. That's less than one half of 1% of all the refugees in the world. And those are people who are designated by the UN High Commissioner for Refugees as refugees. Many migrants who are often deemed undocumented are in fact refugees. Once you ask them three questions, you figure out they're in fact leaving because of persecution. So I think the world in general has a legal framework for dealing with refugees, which was created in 1951 in Geneva. And I think that, there's some effort to live up to it, but in essence, refugees are not, their rights are not protected around the world. The fact that they live in camps without the right to move freely, without the right to work, without the right to do anything is essentially keeping them incarcerated because they've been persecuted. And, by the way, your tax dollars supports that. And we have been fighting for 8 or 9 years trying to get our government, as well as the other donor governments from the EU, Australia, Canada, to look at a different way of treating refugees, because international law actually says refugees have the right to move freely and the right to work. And there's 12 million people who are simply denied those rights every day for 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, and 60 years.
Deep, you count among your colleagues in the tech industry many of the most recent immigrant groups in America, highly skilled, well-educated, maybe individuals from a different geographical area, different continent, different history as well. And you feel that there are all too many barriers to their ability to work in your industry. Tell us about that.
So let's start with some facts that may be a little bit buried. So how many people here know that 40% of all Fortune 500 companies were either founded by an immigrant or the children of an immigrant? Isn't that amazing? Like, that's not the first thing we think about when we think about immigrants. The fact that UC Berkeley did a study and they looked at technology companies formed in the U.S. and Silicon Valley between 1995 and 2005, and found that over 50% of technology companies in the Bay Area and over 25% of technology companies in the country were formed, had at least one co-founder that was an immigrant, right? Someone who had not been born in this country. Those companies combined created $52 billion in revenue over that 10-year period. They also created 450,000 jobs for all of us. So even as we talk about, you know, how difficult it is for people to come in, you just heard, you know, sort of my story, right? I came here in 1990 as a highly educated person in a field where there aren't too many people. In fact, more than 50% of all postgraduates in U.S. universities are not American nationals. We have to import people from elsewhere to study math and science. And these, we can all agree, are the engines of future innovation and growth for us. It's very difficult. I became a naturalized citizen in 2008. That was 18 years after I came here, which meant that I had lived here. My children had been born here. I had paid taxes pretty much all my working life here. And if for some reason I did not get my citizenship, I could be deported on a whim by anybody. Can you imagine someone who's highly skilled and has a lot of opportunity anywhere in the world want to live on the edge like that?
So you know,
it's a very difficult thing.
Yeah. No, I'm just gonna say, by the same token, I mean, you have the workers that are defined as skilled, and yet agriculture workers in this country have a very skilled job as
Absolutely.
Well. I mean, there's approximately 1 million or so farm workers that we estimate are undocumented by the statistics I shared with you all a little bit earlier. And when you look at that workforce, there are very few, if any, legal residents, American citizens that today want to work in agriculture. It's without that skill, someone that can cut the broccoli or the cauliflower or go work in the mushroom factories and so forth. And oftentimes the workers that come, that migrate here from Mexico, have their engineering degrees, their doctors, their have all types of skills in that particular country outside the agricultural industry. And they come here with those types of skills as well. And we find that it's almost impossible to replace those individuals. And so when you hear the Republicans or hear the Tea Parties talking about let's deport all of the immigrants that are here without papers, I mean, I don't think they really imagine, they don't really understand what the realities of something like that would be. I mean, if we got rid of the 1 million agriculture workers that are here in the United States today without papers, we would be found without any food. I mean, that would be the collapse of the agricultural industry as we know it today here in the United States.
Yeah. And, you know, while we talk about, and there isn't perfect employment in this country, right? Let's face it. And times are tough. I lived in the Midwest for 10 years, and I have lots of friends out there who are very skilled and still looking for jobs. So there is definitely that gap, and that's the real white elephant in the room, which everyone talks about, which is, are we displacing these, you know, skilled people within our own country who are citizens, who are born here, and who should have the ability to find high-paying jobs? We have 3.5 million jobs in this country that are unfilled today, which means that 3.5 million people who could be making money and then redistributing that wealth, because they have to be then, you know, they are making a salary, they are paying taxes, they are part of a community. There's a huge opportunity cost of not filling these jobs. There's a skills gap in this country, and we'd be better off as a country trying to focus on the skill gaps, making sure that the right kinds of people are coming here, whether we are training them, which should be first and foremost our priority, or we are bringing them from elsewhere. And there has been historical, you know, evidence in this country where we've done it. In the 60s and 70s, this country imported doctors from everywhere. Again, you know, little known fact, the United States government used to pay foreign medical doctors to take the local tests, because, you know, it used to cost whatever, $20 or $30, and they were like, well, why should we do that? And they would pay for you to take that test if you're willing to come here and practice in this country. And they would, you know, even give you loans if you went in rural areas and practice. If you go in rural areas all around the country, you'll find like 50 and 60-year-old Indian doctors. You know, why do you think they came here? Because they were invited to come here. Today, if you open up the newspaper in, you know, Pennsylvania, you'll see classified ads looking for physical therapists. There's a shortage of physical therapists in this country. There are billboards in little towns in, you know, near Scranton, Pennsylvania, Holmesdale, Pennsylvania, where they're giving you $15,000 bonuses to join as a physical therapist in those, you know, hospitals, because they can't find enough of them. They are all being imported from other places. So we have a history of doing it. If we can be very specific and very coordinated in doing it, whether it is skilled farm laborers or doctors or physicians or engineers or scientists, I think the innovation machine in this country can continue going, and we would all be better off as a result.
Dulce, you wanted to make a comment. I don't know if we've moved beyond the point that you wanted to make, but please.
I was blessed to graduate from Carr Hitting High School, and they had a program, a robotics program, that whose mission was to stimulate and motivate students to go into science, technology, engineering, and math. So I decided to be an engineer because I was part of the robotics team. So when I go to Arizona State University, most of my peers, like 2/3 of them, it were either from China or India. And there's nothing wrong with that, but I started thinking that my peers, when I'll talk to them, they will go back to their country. I was like, the next bubble that I see is green technology. Where is the United States going to get enough intellectual scientists to be leading in that age? And if we want to continue being a first world country, we need to be able to compete. And I just see that we're not fulfilling and educating enough people into going to STEM programs. And then I look back to my high school, and there's a wonderful mentor. And a lot of people are going into engineering. A lot of them are undocumented. I have a friend that just graduated from Arizona State University with a 4.1 GPA from the Mechanical School of Engineering, and she's undocumented. She can get a job anywhere else in the world but the United States. And that makes me think, are we evicting the next Albert Einstein? Or if Albert Einstein wanted to get a H-1 visa, would he be able to get it today? And I'm
actually, no, because the quota for 2013 was just filled up on June 12th.
Those are things that we really need to think about. And right now, our young people are not willing to go into STEM education. And there's a real gap right there. And I advocate for the DREAM Act, but we're also advocating for STEM education. And a lot of undocumented students are going into that route.
Mm-hmm. Lavinia, you?
Actually, Einstein came as a refugee. FYI. I'm, you know, absolutely in agreement with Deep. I mean, we need to be obviously bringing people into the country who have the skills and education that are going to benefit. But I think also we need to keep in mind that you really can't predict people's success in the United States. It's one of the great things about this country. You can bring someone in with no education and they can end up doing fabulous things. And I just want to point out that there's a billion-dollar industry in this country, which is not in the Fortune 500, created almost solely by Vietnamese refugees. And many people in this room probably participate in this once or twice a month. And that's the nail industry, okay? And these are uneducated people for the most part who are working very hard. Farm workers, not quite so hard, but working very hard, but have created this billion-dollar need that everyone has, which we didn't used to have. And this is their creativity, their drive, their ability to see a gap and fill it, and that's what immigrants and refugees have done for this country since the beginning.
Yeah. I want to go back to Deep with a question having to do with the H-1B visa. System, which is the system that we have, the mechanism that we have for bringing in and allowing in legally highly skilled workers in certain industries, STEM. Well, it's not quite defined in the context, but it's very similar. As a journalist in the Bay Area, occasionally I come across conversations where people talk about abuse in the workplace. And one of the refrains that one hears is that in places, in workplaces where there is an abundance of individuals working on H-1B visas, the employers hold the upper hand to a fault. And I just wonder if you, and that is basically that they have string that they can cut at any time and the individual drifts away from the country and the job. Do you have a sense at all as to any remedies for that kind of situation? If, or do you agree that this situation exists in some workplaces?
Right. You know, I don't have first-hand knowledge of that, so it would be difficult to comment on, you know, whether it exists or not. But I'm a big believer in free markets. And what I do know is, you know, if I need to hire a highly skilled engineer or designer or web developer or data scientist, which I hire by tens every day, so if anyone in the audience is a great engineer or web developer, or you have friends, you know, jobs@linkedin.com, please send in your LinkedIn profile links to us. I don't ask what nationality they are, right? Our company doesn't ask what nationality they are. We want the best and the brightest, and we are very willing to pay market rates because that's what they command. Skills don't have nationality attached to them. Skills have the ability to generate return on investment, return on equity, return on assets for our shareholders. And as a free market proponent, as you know, most companies are, we all care about that. And even if there are temporary anomalies of what you're talking about, where you know, if people on certain visas feel like they're at a disadvantage or they don't speak up for their rights, those would be all temporary because the free market normally corrects itself. You know, a skilled worker can always find a job somewhere else, and H-1s are transferable, so it's not as if they are tied to a given company. And those things more often than not end up being very temporary and not a permanent artifact.
Mm-hmm. Quick comment from you, Arturo. The free market always corrects itself?
No, you know it. I'll speak in relationship to agriculture.
Of course.
You know, to what's happening right now is, and I'm sure a lot of you may have seen reports about there's a shortage of labor. Have y'all read? You know, in fact, in reality is that, you know, because of the tightenings of the borders, because of more enforcement of immigration laws, because of more opportunities available, because of the difficulties in terms of trying to cross the borders and all those kinds of things, yes, in fact, there are less immigrants coming in to work in the agricultural industry today. There's no doubt about that. But in terms of what it's done, and I'll just give you a good example in the Salinas Valley, where we're very close to the Salad Bowl of America, and everybody's talked shortage of labor all this season. They don't have enough workers to work in the broccoli or cut the lettuce or whatever particular crop they're working in, and yet at the same time, there's been no wage increases. Farm workers don't get medical plans. None of them have a pension plan unless they work under a United Farm Workers contract. And so those are the realities. So I would say in agriculture, no, the free market doesn't impact in the way that it might in other particular industries as a result of it, even though when there's a pronounced shortage of labor by the industry itself saying that there's not enough workers to pick their jobs. Their response is, well, we're just going to plant less crops next year. We're going to plant less acreage so that we don't have a need for the amount of workers that, or for the workers that are available right now to us. Instead of raising wages, instead of providing medical benefits or providing pension plans and things like that, which workers obviously deserve, they're not willing to do that.
Dulce, many Americans remember your face as the face of advocacy for the DREAM Act. There have been a number of dramatic situations where you have become emblematic of the struggle for that. In June, President Obama announced that the U.S. will stop deporting and began giving work permits to undocumented immigrants who came to the U.S. as children and who are no older than 30, 31 years old, have not yet quite reached 31 now. It may not have been the DREAM Act that you struggled for years, but it was a dream action, I suspect, for you and for 800,000 young immigrants like you. How is the president's action affecting the lives of people in your life, and how is it not making a difference?
Well, when we heard Obama's announcement, I personally was really happy because it meant that we're going to be able to protect a certain population of undocumented students. Because once a dreamer gets deported, there's nobody that is going to say, whoops, we made a mistake, let's bring him back, or we're going to write legislation to bring him back. And I'm happy on the aspect that it's going to stop the deportation of some dreamers. But at the same time, it comes into a time that it's on a presidential election. And there was also a lot of pressure from DREAM activist groups that were telling the truth about the record-breaking deportations that are happening in the United States. More than a million people on his presidency. We also... I'm very concerned about the implementation of this process because he announced it on June 15. We're still waiting for the final guidelines. And then after that, what is going to be the actual process to put all these streamers into actually getting their work permits? And we know that this is just a policy and it's a temporary fix. And if there's a change in power and the presidency, the next person could take this policy away. So it means a lot, but at the same time, we know that there's a lot of work ahead of us. And there's a lot of education that has to go into it. We know that there are a lot of people, a lot of dreamers are being scammed as we speak because they're opportunistic lawyers or notarios that are saying, come and apply, and there's no action process. So there's a lot of gaps, but it's a step towards the right direction. And we feel that we're gonna have to come out as a Latino community to come out and vote and to make sure that the policies like President Obama's announcement are going to stay in place and that we're going to get a permanent legislation like the DREAM Act.
And I just want to add, first of all, Dulce, want to applaud you and all the DREAM students and activists, what y'all have done and what you've accomplished, because despite the fact it's not everything we want, and the fact that it came in election year, it came. Mm-hmm. And so that tells me, elections do make a difference as a result of it. But I think at the same time, I think we all have a challenge now. And, listening to Deep and what he's saying and what Lavinia's saying about refugees, as the immigrant community as a whole, we have to go beyond where we're at right now. And we've certainly experienced it with agricultural workers. The last administration, on the last day that they were in office, they changed the rules and regulations for H-2A workers, for guest workers that are brought into only the agricultural industry here in the United States, took away all the protections that we had fought for decades. And one swipe of the pen did everything, did away with wage protections, did away with protections for American workers here in the United States, took away the protections for having housing and those types of things. So that I think, we have to not only make sure that we get what the president has already announced that he's going to do, but simultaneously as an immigrant community figure out how we are going to make this permanent. and go beyond what it is. And then, obviously, we're all fighting for, agriculture workers are fighting for ag jobs, which would deal with the agricultural industry when farm workers, a million plus farm workers that are there, that are without papers, without legal status in this country, and we have comprehensive immigration reform. But I think, to me, what you've done is given us all hope that if we do the types of actions and activities that you all did so faithfully and so religiously, that we're going to succeed.
I agree. Like, a lot of people were interviewing, like, what do you think about Obama expanding on the Latino vote? And what's wrong with that? And I mean, there's a lot of work ahead of us. And although a lot of people may remember my face, is that I was just taking all the credit from all the work that has been paid ahead of myself. Like, I can see in the audience, Yahaira, I remember she did a nonviolent civil disobedience inside Senator McCain's office in Tucson, Arizona. And that also motivated me to do a nonviolent civil disobedience in Washington, D.C., inside Senator McCain's office. So we see the power of the youth and the organizing. And sometimes, like, I know I wanted to quit many times. And a lot of people would tell you, like, this won't work. And we had a lot of defeats on the way, but we have a victory. And this is going to give us a lot more strength to fight for the DREAM Act, to fight for comprehensive immigration reform, and bigger goals for our communities, like getting education and being empowered.
Lavinia, a few months ago, over a period of a few days, more than 200 children trickled unaccompanied by their parents across the U.S. border from Mexico into southern Texas. Governor Rick Perry, among other things, released a letter to President Obama taking the president to task for allowing the U.S. to become a, quote, temptation, luring children in a dangerous journey to the U.S. I think you have a different take on those young people, who I believe you call children of Exodus. Tell us about it.
Yes, it's a relatively recent phenomena of undocumented, unaccompanied children coming across the border. Most of these children are 14, 15, 16, 17, and most of them are coming to be with family, very often a parent or both parents. And a lot of them are also fleeing violence in their home countries, gang recruitment, and dysfunctional situations. And I think what you can look at, it's you know, there's a new policy where they're apprehended by ICE, then they're put in the custody of the Office of Refugee Resettlement, who then, after a relatively short period of time, releases most of the children to friends or family, and then they're supposed to then go to immigration court. You should know that immigrants do not have a right to an attorney in immigration court, so you can have situations of a five-year-old facing a government lawyer and a judge and no attorney. Okay? So we have a program where we provide pro bono attorneys for these children. But broadly, I think that when you look at the history of immigration law in this country, and recently, in the last 20 years, how it's been constantly tightened and tightened and tightened, in particular in, is it 96, where Immigration Reform Act was passed. And it made it so that if you were found undocumented in this country, there would be at least a 10-year bar before you could ever come back. So instead of going home to visit your children you left with your mother, you just didn't go back. Right. So the cross-border that used to happen when I was young, people would come up for the harvest and then go back home. Fathers would come up and work and then go back for Christmas and visit their families and bring presents. And so the now the way the border is and the way the laws are, people leave their children as babies with their parents. They come up to work and find they can't possibly go back. So the child grows up. Grandparents are getting old, dysfunctional family. Mom's in New York City. I'm going to go. And they have these horrible journeys on the trains. They go on the top of the trains, and they're they're trafficked, they're murdered, they're, you know, they are prostituted, they're raped. I mean, it's a really a bad situation. The lucky ones get to the border. Some of them get across without being apprehended. But, you know, this new phenomena where we're luring these children into the United States, you know, when you look at our laws, we're the ones that are keeping these families separate. And these teenagers see no option for themselves, most of them are teenagers, other than to take that chance. And, you know, I did this little op-ed, and I wanted to put in there, you know, look, Americans can't control their own teenagers. Why do you think we're going to control those teenagers? Okay? But it really shows how draconian our borders are and how, you know, strong the need for children to be with their families. So we have to have more humane laws.
To those of you in the audience in this room, in a few minutes we're going to be taking questions from you to the panelists. So if you will begin to make your way to, there is a microphone there on my right, and there on my left, or your right and your left, it's both. I do want to touch on and ask for a quick answer from each one of you to one question before we get to questions from the audience. In the first quarter of this year alone, there were 865 bills and resolutions relating to immigrants and refugees that were introduced in the legislatures of 45 states. The federal government doesn't get around to legislating on immigration. The states are quite ready to step into what they perceive to be a gap. And if you think that 865 bills is a lot, in 2011, the number was 1,538 in the same period of time. Now, I wonder if I could begin with you, Arturo, whether you sense, is this a good thing or not? Are the taking together these bills that touch on everything from health to education to social conditions and so on, are they a good thing or a bad thing for your constituency?
Well, in our particular case, it's a bad thing. I mean, you know, most of these laws, and we'll go to the state of Arizona, where Dulce is from, but most of the laws are very negative. They paint the immigrant community in a way, Raul, that vilifies them and makes them look like the criminals, makes them look like the individuals that are violating the laws, and puts them in the eyes of the American public as that these folks are not human beings like the rest of us are. They're not worthy of being here in the United States. And so, you know, we're fighting those particular laws. We're trying to do everything we can to prevent them. And you see states like Alabama and Georgia, where they've actually implemented very strict laws, and the state of Arizona, that the ag industry there in those particular states is collapsing, is going downhill as a result of it because they can't find anybody to work in the agricultural fields. And so I think overall for our nation, it's very bad for, first of all, just the immediate jobs, but all of the jobs that come as a result of that. One in four jobs in agriculture begin with the farm worker. And then you have the transportation and the productions and the retail industry and so forth. So when the ag industry collapses, so do many other jobs as a result of that.
We are going to need to go to questions from the audience very quickly. Pradeep, any experience, any sense of whether there are state bills in California or elsewhere that are affecting people in your industry and your colleagues?
No personal experience, but all I can say is the only people that more legislation and more laws benefit are the lawyers, with due respect for any of the lawyers in the audience.
I mean, in Arizona, we've seen the laws that are using the concept of enforcement through attrition, which the concept is they want to make it so bad for immigrants so they can self-deport. And I don't think legislatures understand the complex of an immigrant family, that there's mixed status. Like, the older folks might be undocumented, and the younger ones may be documented. So this issue needs to be solved at the federal government, and we need to pass pro-immigrant legislation and reform our laws.
Lavinia?
Well, the anti-immigrant forces have succeeded, as Arturo said, in demonizing undocumented people as somehow other and alien and bad and wrong. They're not content with that. They have recently started to pass laws. Tennessee passed a law saying they wanted a moratorium on refugee arrivals. New Hampshire tried to pass a law like that earlier this year. Luckily, that was stopped. we see this if you get on the right or the wrong, but mainly the right websites, you can see a movement to try and keep refugees from coming to their community.
I have a reminder to our audience. This program is presented by the Commonwealth Club, Clubs Inforum, Connect Your Intellect, in partnership with the U.S. Committee for Refugees and Immigrants. And tonight we're hosting New Lives and Old Dreams, Immigration in America 2012. Now let's hear from our audience. I believe you will be at the first comment.
Yes, this question will be for Deep. My name is Rodrigo Rumana. I'm a finance director for HP, and like you, I have all the letters for the visas, actually including one, J-1, before my H-1. Not long ago, I'm a user for LinkedIn, and I remember LinkedIn hosting President Obama talking about jobs and jobs creation for this country. You sit in a very strategic seat in LinkedIn, and you also mentioned about some of the gaps that you have today in terms of demand for workforce, like 3.9 million jobs, and the lack of supply. Have you thought about how the impact that LinkedIn could do in terms of maybe a product idea of kind of analyzing people that are there or the interest for people, and that could direct them for maybe the, physical therapists, gap in Pennsylvania? Is this something that is in the charter of LinkedIn or something that you would influence?
So absolutely. So earlier this year, we did some work with the President's Council of Economic Advisors to do research on exactly this. So we have a lot of data in terms of where the skill gaps are and where the opportunities may be. And when you combine it with government data sources such as the Bureau of Labor Statistics, you can find some very interesting things. And, we call this notion the notion of an opportunity graph. The United States, sitting far back in India, we always used to think of this country as the land of opportunity, because that's how the United States has always been. And I would love for us to continue being that way and not become land of scarcity for these highly skilled people, no matter where they reside in the world. And so we have the notion of an opportunity graph that we are developing, along with a lot of other highly public sources to figure out exactly what you're talking about. And it's absolutely in our charter, which is to connect talent with opportunity at massive scale.
We have a question on the other side.
Yes. As a native woman of Chiricahua Apache, immigration and movement, I guess I would say, on my continent is really important to me. And even as I would say a real American, if that's any way that I could say, because we don't really use that word, we don't call ourselves American, we have trouble, crossing borders. And last year, going up to the International Indigenous Leadership Conference in Canada, in British Columbia, we were stopped at the border. Every single time we crossed the border, we're detained. The kids a lot of times are taken into separate rooms and interrogated, especially after 9/11, because some of my boys looked Islamic. And so they were taken in and interrogated into different rooms. Last year was the most surprising process, because when we did cross the border, they pulled us in, interrogated us, and tried to find something wrong with us. And they couldn't. And so at one point they came up with something. And so they said, okay, for $200 you can cross the border and get a 6-day citizenship pass or something like that. So, we paid the $200 because we needed to get to the conference. So, that's a concern that even us that aren't necessarily, I don't want to use the word immigrants, but we can't travel. So I would really like, I guess, to address Arturo and maybe Lavinia on that, because I'm happy to see that you're now addressing the indigenous issue, which is happening in a lot of the farm worker camps. There's a lot of tribes that are actually cut by the border.
Could we stay with the question? We are running out of time,
okay,
so
sure.
We'd like to hear from them.
So there's a lot of tribes that are cut by the border. So my question would be, in the sense of policies by the U.S., whether they're cut by the border or not, is that going to be any different for an indigenous farm worker trying to get labor, or how they're seen and their immigration process is handled?
Unfortunately, in case of farm workers, indigenous or someone coming from an urban community, they're all treated the same. There is no distinction. But I would say that the indigenous farm worker even has more problems once they arrive here in this particular country, because oftentimes they speak different languages, and so as a result, they don't even necessarily speak Spanish. So they have difficulties in the job. They have difficulties. Their children have difficulties in schools. They have difficulties working with any of the other systems that are agencies here within the United States as a result of that. And it's hard enough to find a Spanish translator, much less someone that can speak other dialects and other languages outside of Spanish.
So that would even be if it's a chartered U.S. tribe.
Yes.
Let's move on.
Hi, my name is Edward. Questions for Dulce. It's an honor to see you here. My girlfriend's an undocumented American. She's openly undocumented. She's a proud undocumented American. And we met at college, and so I want to ask you about the direction of the very youth-led undocumented movement and an issue you brought up of college access for Dreamers. My girlfriend knows she's very fortunate to be at college, and like you, have a college education without a Social Security number, and that 90 to 95% of Dreamers aren't in that narrative of Dreamers who are able to go to college. So we started organizing against our colleges for putting Dreamers in the international pool.
And we have only seconds left, so if you take.
So do you see a direction of the movement of targeting private institutions and being able to increase college access through that way?
I think college access for undocumented students is becoming harder. When I wanted to go to college, I was able to pay in-state tuition. Then laws changed it to out-of-state tuition. And I think we definitely need to start challenging the process of getting a scholarship. Like some organizations shouldn't be asking you for citizenship, and there's very scarce resources, and a lot of people are doing personal fundraising. You see more of that. And yes, I do see the movement challenging universities and organizations to provide more scholarships to undocumented students.
I have to correct myself. We have more than 10 seconds. It was 10 minutes that we had left. It just said 10 and scared me. Please, and if you could keep it to questions.
Sure. So hi, my name is Jessica Thurgelson. I work for Asylum Access, an international refugee rights organization. And my question is directed at Lavinia.
Could you move a little closer to the microphone?
Sure. Lavinia, you mentioned that less than 1% of all refugees will ever make it to the United States. In your experience, how does the way that we treat refugees and immigrants in our own country impact our ability to encourage other countries to respect the rights of refugees and migrants?
Lavinia, that's for you.
Well, it's a great question, because throughout the last few decades, there have been instances where the United States clearly is not a paragon of virtue when it comes to the way it treats people who are clearly refugees. You may remember the Cuban Mariel boat lift, and then Haitians also came. The way we treat Cubans is very different than the way we treat Haitians. It's just a lot. Cubans who land, get a foot on the United States, can then move on to get a green card. Haitians typically are incarcerated and then deported. We actually have a system. We made a deal with Castro. It's one of the few things that we could deal about. We said, if you keep people from leaving Cuba, then we will take 20,000 people a year from Cuba through a lottery system. And so we basically traded off the management of this deportation with people's right to flee persecution. And for Haitians, you can see people are interdicted at sea. You get on a small boat trying to come from Haiti, the Coast Guard will come and say, why are you on a boat? And you'll be looking up saying, help. And they'll say, well, unless you say that I'm being persecuted and I'd like asylum, you have to use those words, then it's not, you know, you're not going to get asylum in the United States. It makes it really difficult to argue to other countries to do the right thing when you have that kind of experience.
Question over here. Just questions,
yes.
Please.
Thank you very much for allowing me to speak before you. During the late President Roosevelt administration, he implemented the Bracero Plan. Why can't a similar plan be implemented now? Also, too, this immigration plan, undocumented people coming over, nationals coming over, suffering so much. This is the responsibility also of the president of Mexico. He cannot go unscathed. We must make it his responsibility to answer for all this. Thank you.
Arturo?
Yes, in relationship to the Bracero program, that was implemented back during the Second World War, during that particular time, because so many of our men had gone off to war and they needed people to work in the factories. So they brought over, and the agricultural industry, so they brought over literally tens of thousands of folks from Mexico and from other countries. The problem with the program was that people were abused, they were exploited. Everything that was said that in terms of the protections was not there for those workers, nor was it there for American workers, especially when they returned here to the United States. So consequently, our organization, United Farm Workers, Cesar Chavez, Dolores Huerta, many others, we worked extremely hard to do away with the Bracero program. By 1964, we were successful doing that. Later on, it was replaced with what currently exists today, and there is an H-2A guest worker program that specifically works with agricultural workers here in this country. And there are protections ensuring that the wage that they're paid takes care of the needs that they have here, plus realizing that they have families that they've had to leave from their sending country. Takes care of making sure that they have housing when they come here, transportation is paid for, and we do everything that we can to enforce those laws. And there's about 60,000 to 65,000 guest workers that are brought into the United States every year to work in agriculture today.
Another question.
Hi, Arturo. I was wondering if you might be able to touch on the Take Our Jobs campaign, and the stats are really fascinating on that.
Sure. You know, 2 years ago, we were working and we were meeting actually at our national headquarters, the National Chavez Center, and we were meeting there with farm worker leadership trying to discuss this whole issue of immigration and trying to figure out, okay, how do we better present it to the public? Because for some reason, we're looked upon as not being equals and treated as second-class citizens and everything else. And during the discussion, one of the farm workers, Raul, came up and said that, you know what, I got an idea. Why don't we invite them to take our jobs if they think it's so easy to do or they want to do this kind of work? And so consequently, the other worker came up and says, well, yeah, let's call it Take Our Jobs. And we sat there and, you know, we being kind of trying to take into account everything that was being said, we said, what, Take Our Jobs? We're going to invite people to do work in agriculture. At any rate, we thought about it for a couple of months. We decided, okay, let's do the campaign, put it together. We announced it. Stephen Colbert, he got all excited about it. And so I didn't know who Stephen Colbert was. But they said it was a good thing. We'd get out a lot of, you know, we'd get the word, we'd get the message out. So we put up a website, Take Our Jobs website. Millions of people went to the website. And then we were on three different segments of Stephen Colbert's show. And he actually went and worked out in the fields in New York. I got to see him. He worked with his blue jeans and his garb on and out there working in the fields trying to utilize what do you call those pickers, you know, to pick up trash. He was out there trying to pick the crops with it. But at any rate, it did bring a lot of new information to the public. And out of those tens of thousands of people that went to our website and actually applied for jobs, only 11 people worked in agriculture one day. And that was it. I just remember one, and I'll just share this one quick story. One person called up and asked, do they provide transportation to and from your house? Is it air conditioning out in the fields? And we said, no, it's not air conditioning. It's those kinds of things. But people really didn't understand what it was to work, but they didn't last either.
And I highly recommend the video of Arturo's appearance in the Colbert Show. You can find it on the internet. It's good. Please.
Yes, I'd like to the panel to reply to the following. Should the United States have an open border policy as far as immigration? And if not, what restrictions would you think is the right restrictions to have on the U.S. economy?
In 10 seconds?
In 15 seconds, please.
In 15 seconds. Well, you know, I'm actually a fan of open borders. I know that that comes back to haunt me because then everything else I say gets discredited. But it's almost like the free market. That if you really had open borders, people would go where they saw their best chance and opportunity would be. It would also put a lot of countries on notice that they needed to make things better or they'd be sitting there staring at each other. So, you know, I think that's a good thing. It's fairly unrealistic at this point of view, point of time. So, when you look at comprehensive immigration reform, the problem with comprehensive immigration reform is you have to balance things. You've got to have controls over your border, and sovereign states are supposed to have controls. At the same time, you do want to bring in the talented and educated to help the country grow. The same time you have humanitarian issues, you have 11 million people here undocumented who need to get a path to citizenship, and people are on so polarized that they want, you know, electrified borders so people will die if they get within 10 feet, or, you know, they just want open borders, okay? So I'm sort of on this side. But the reality is that we've got to balance, and frankly, in Washington, we can't balance anything now.
I think that we need to do feasible and practical solutions, and saying that we're going to have an open border is not practical, or saying we're going to deport them all or we're going to legalize them all is not practical. I think we need to have a system to figure out who are the people that we want here as a nation. And that can be highly skilled workers. That can be people that are going into STEM education. And there has to be some processes, and there's going to be faults, and there's going to be good things about it, but I don't think an open border is going to be a feasible, practical solution.
Well, I think that that's going to have to be the last set of answers. It's a good question, and the last set of answers, because we have to move to tradition now. It is time for a last question that is a tradition in the INFORM programs, and is to ask each one of our speakers the following question. To each of our panelists, what are your 60-second ideas to change the world? Lavinia, change the world for us.
I actually would advocate for open borders. That if you give people dignity and opportunity and their rights, that people will go where it makes sense to go for them. Some people are never going to leave home. You all know people like that. You grew up with them. They're still there, okay? And other people want to get up and move, and they have the kind of drive and other reasons to move. You know, the nation state is a relatively new phenomena in human history, and I don't think we need to respect it the way we do. And I think we need to respect people's rights more than we do the nation state.
Dulce, your turn to change the world.
I would change the culture of youth actually thinking that STEM education is actually fun when they're in high school, right? Like we see that we help a lot of the coaches that are coaching the basketball or football, and everybody wants to go into that, right? But think about it. How many people can get to be professional basketball players or football players? So changing the culture into youth, going into STEM education, anybody can be an engineer. Anybody can be a scientist as long as you apply yourself into it. So I would change the culture in our high schools.
Thank you. Deep.
Yeah. I think compassion. A lot of ills in the world happen because it's very difficult for us to really appreciate what other human beings go through. It's, you know, it's the Come Take Our Jobs program. It all seems easy, but we are not willing to do it. And when we try it, we understand how difficult those things are. And the world needs more compassion. And if we all had compassion, I think it would be a much better place.
Arturo, you get the last
word. You know, there's nothing more basic than food in our nation. And we laugh about it, but yet, I mean, how do we treat the people that harvest our fruits and vegetables here in the United States? I think we need to understand it's a global food supply today, and we have a responsibility here as consumers to make sure that we do something to raise the level, to raise the status of farm workers in our nation, but go beyond that. We have to go beyond our borders because 50% of the food we consume that comes out of Costco or it comes out of Save Mart, it comes out of Safeway, comes from other countries. And so we have a real challenge about how we're going to treat with respect and dignity farm workers throughout the world, as opposed to just here in the U.S., and also simultaneously ensure that consumers have a safe food supply. And that way, we protect consumers, and we provide workers with the dignity and respect they deserve.
Let's give a big round of applause to Arturo, Dulce, Lavinia, and Dean. Now, this meeting of Inform and the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.